You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Farad. Coming up, we'll get an update on the U.S. fight against ISIS after President Trump declared the group defeated in Syria and called for American troops to come home.
Now, some people will spend hours camping out to get tickets to a sporting event or show. Others might spend hundreds of dollars for costumes for cosplay. Taking extreme measures as a fan isn't anything new. People's fascinations and obsessions have been a part of human life for quite a while. Let's take a trip back in time to the 1960s when a certain boy band was making international fame.
How long do you think Beatlemania will last?
As long as you all keep coming.
Beatles for them, and I'll always love them. Even when I'm 105 and an old grandmother, I love them. And Paul McCartney, if you are listening, Adrian from Brooklyn loves you with all her heart. I love you, Paul, and please come to the window so I can just see you. I saw you smoking before, and I kissed the limousine you looked out of. But I love you, and I want you, Paul. Please look at it. And Ringo, you can look at it too, because I like you.
Maybe you're not quite as obsessed as that particular Beatles fan. That's okay. You don't have to be completely obsessed to be a fan. Whether you're fixated on a new TV show, going out to all the concerts of a favorite artist, or just screaming at the TV wearing all your favorite sports teams' jerseys, there's many ways to be a fan, and it can have lasting effects on our daily lives.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a big fan of something? A movie, a comic, a sports team, an artist, whatever it may be, call in with your stories. How did your fandom start? And why do you like being a fan? Call in at 800-642-1234 or leave us a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Regan Gurung is the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joins us now to talk about the psychology of being a fan. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
There you are. Great. So what is it? What's going on in our brains when we latch onto something as a full-on fan?
So a lot's going on, actually. And I think right at the onset, being a fan, it's fun to be a fan. And whenever something is fun, it feels good. And whenever something feels good, our brain likes to feel good. So it releases all these chemicals that we enjoy. And here's where it gets tricky. We enjoy those chemicals and we want more. So we start searching out more opportunities to get some more of that fun. So right at the very core of it, there's this really neat interaction between it being fun, that fun being rewarding. And so we work harder and harder to get more of those rewards.
Regan, were you ever a big fan of anything growing up?
You know, I think there's a key phrase in there is growing up. And as yes, absolutely. I was a fan of many things. And as I reflect on it, I think I was a much bigger fan in a much bigger way when I was younger than I am now. And but I was reflecting on that. And I think that's why so many of the things that we are fans for, we tend to be fans of and develop when we are younger. And I think that's especially the case for sports team fandom in particular, but for a lot of other things as well.
Now, we're talking about individual fans and what it does for us, but there's also fandom, the community of fans. Is there kind of that social connection angle if we're a fan of, the Beatles and standing in a crowd, or a fan of a team and we know other people around the world are watching with us on TV?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as far as there's this notion of group membership, because being a fan together with other fans, it does a lot of different things. So, for example, you are now a member of the group. And a funny thing happens when you look at what happens with group membership. Whenever we are a member of a group, we assume that those other people in that group are like us. It gets even crazier, actually. When we are a member of a group, we think our group is better, and anybody not in our group is not as good. And I think you also see that definitely with fandom, where you can take very normal people, and the moment they realize that that normal person who was once normal is a fan of another team or something else, automatically we start seeing these differences between us and them. And this is such a pervasive phenomena that you can divide people up into groups on something seemingly innocuous, and you'll still see these same dynamics taking place.
You know, it seems like fandom is a common occurrence with teenagers, although I would argue that adults get heavily involved in it too. But posters on the wall, listening to a particular album, do you see fandom as a particularly big piece of teenage life?
I see fandom and some of the elements of fandom as being more prevalent during certain stages of development than others. And I know that was a very long answer to a very simple question, but it's more because there are so many different elements of fandom. I think, you know, there's the fun element and the rewarding element that I talked about, but I think there's also this notion of identity. When you see, let's just take a singer, when you see a singer or a band whose lyrics resonate, whose music seems to be speaking to you, and if you are at that point in your life when maybe you think nobody's listening to you, where maybe you're experiencing certain issues, well, if there's this band that's singing about exactly what you're experiencing, your connection, your attachment is going to be so much greater. And I think that tends to happen when we are younger versus then when we are older, although it can certainly happen at any stage of the life cycle.
Talking about the psychology of being a fan of whatever, anything. Regan Gurung is with us from UW Green Bay. And Regan, let's talk about, there's sometimes a dark side of fandom, especially I think in the age of the internet. You see people who are into computer gaming or role-playing games or Star Wars sometimes turning against other fans who don't look like them or are not the gender, say, they expect,
right,
or the ethnic or racial group that they associate with that kind of fandom. And it gets sometimes really ugly. What happens? Why would it go in that direction?
So once, you know, this sort of builds on what I said earlier as far as that group membership goes. You know, the moment you have this strong group identity, you get defensive about your group. And anybody who seems to be violating or going against what you believe your group stands for is somebody who you can tend to dislike. Now, there's something else that's going on here too, and that's when we talk about levels of fandom. In that great opening clip, with the woman or girl talking about Paul McCartney, I mean, part of me wants to say, gosh, I wish we could find her to see if she still feels that way. You know, maybe she will be at Paul McCartney's concert at Lambeau Field next year. You know, it's still going strong, but it's those levels, right, that make a difference. We talk about obsession. We talk about infatuation. I think you can be a fan and have a very healthy relationship with your fandom and actually with your life. But you could also be that fan where it reaches a point that it interferes with your normal functioning, where you know your identity with that group or that individual becomes so strong that any threat to that individual or that identity makes you react. So I think it's this notion. I think many of us are fans of many things, but it varies in the extent to which we are fans and how much out of our way we will go, how much we'll inconvenience ourselves to nurture that fandom. And I think that's one of those things that's where the dark side comes in. And of course, it can happen, but the key is catch yourself so that you don't let it hurt you or others.
Well, you know, there's a lot of hobby conventions around now, from anime conventions to comic cons. What do you think the experience of attending one of these conventions, or if you're like a big music fan, attending a big concert has on us?
Well, and let's break that up into two, because I think the comic cons and, you know, those kinds of conventions, here's an opportunity where you get to learn more and more and more about whatever you're really interested in. The big concerts, I think there are definitely some really neat similarities that we can look at. And what's happening here is it goes beyond this something in just your head to something that you are now sharing with many other individuals. Especially if you talk about a concert, there's the situation, there's the sounds, there's the special effects, there's all these other folks in that concert arena sharing that same experience. And now the sights, the sounds, that visceral experience feeds that fandom, and I think gives us such a high that it can be addictive. I mean, you can crave it. That's why so many of us spend so much money to go to concerts. I think the same thing with Comic-Con. It's one thing, and in this day and age with the internet, it's relatively easy to sit at your computer and learn all you can about a certain comic book or a certain movie. Or, you know, if you know there's a movie coming down the pike, you know, let's say, The Joker, there's a new Joker mm-hmm. movie, and you want to know more about it. And, you know, ooh, there was a special clip of the Joker, first look at the new costume. Well, that's one thing you can do when you're on the internet. But if you go to a Comic-Con or something like that, at one shot for almost 10, 12 or more hours a day, you can feed that yearning for that more information, and that can be intoxicating and a lot of fun.
Regan Gurung is with us from UW Green Bay. We're talking about the psychology of being a fan and how it can affect a person's life.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be a fan of something, a team, a book series, a particular musician or artist? What's the most extreme thing you've done as part of that obsession? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're talking with Regan Gurung, Professor of Human Development and Psychology at UW Green Bay. And we're having a conversation about the psychology of being a fan.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or have you ever been a big fan of something? However you want to define that, call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Leslie in Platteville. Hello, Leslie. How are you? Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. My name's Leslie. I'm from Platteville. Love the show. I had to call in because I am known for being a huge fan of The Legend of Zelda video game. In fact, with a lot of my friends who are into gaming and anime, they know me as Zelda. I cosplay. I have four different outfits for Zelda, four different versions of Zelda. I've also dressed up as Link. My students know it. My classroom has Legend of Zelda stuff in it. My house has Zelda stuff in it. And this year I was fortunate enough to meet two of the voice actors who were wow. in the most recent video game.
Nice.
Including the actress who voiced Zelda herself. So that was really cool.
Very cool, Leslie. Thank you so much for the call. Regan, what do you think about fans of video games like The Legend of Zelda and so many others that are out there?
You know, I think most video games have such a wonderful way of taking us into these worlds that are so different from reality. And, you know, there's a lot of Breath of the Wild played in my household. So, Leslie, I know, I hear you on what you're talking about. And I think what's really neat here, and that's one of the things that we find, is people who play more video games, who read more fiction, right, and video games as fiction, but tend to, it actually enhances their creativity. And I think that's something we don't talk about enough. Now, of course, if you're playing it all the time, if the first thing you do the moment you wake up in the morning is turn and switch it on, well, that's obviously not healthy. But used in moderation, video games, and especially some of the wonderful stuff that you see now in terms of Zelda and things like that, can take you to some place that it can be really good for creativity and how you think. Again, as long as it's not interrupting with what else is going on. And I think all those things Leslie mentioned, those different dimensions, I mean, here's a great example of how if you really like something, if you have, you know, artifacts or amiibos of it around your house or posters, just looking at it can remind you of the pleasure you get from it and sort of keep those good feelings going.
Thanks for the call, Zelda. I mean, Leslie, we'll go now to Mark with us in Three Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
What are you a fan of, Mark?
Well, I'm a fan of PBS Radio and TV. Why? Because I'm trying to get informed and learn something. And I find you guys to be the best source of it all.
Huh. Mark, thank you so much. That's very nice to say. And Regan, you know, people with something like public radio or public TV, they'll get those tote bags or mugs or whatever, and they'll kind of they'll flaunt their identity, their support, their fandom for that thing that they like.
You know, and just something to add to what Mark said when he talked about the curiosity and wanting to learn stuff, you actually see that in certain forms of fandom where, for example, fans of TV shows. So Mark mentioned PBS, but TV shows in general, things on Netflix, for example, you see the true fan who wants to know more, who wants to talk about the show with somebody. And I think that's a really neat element, too, where you dig deeper to learn more because it's intellectually stimulating. And that's another whole dimension and level that you can get out of it.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Bruce in Madison. Good afternoon, Bruce. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. Okay, I'm a Chicago Bears fan. Am I on? Okay, I'm a Chicago Bears fan, and I'm 72 years old, and I think it's because I played football in high school, and I was a South Bend Central Bear. And we had a C on the side of our helmet and the same color and everything.
Nice.
And it was an important part of my life. I've always been a Chicago Bears fan. I get nervous before the game. It ruins my week when they lose, and I'm thrilled throughout the week when they win. Totally irrational. I can't explain it, but it's definitely there.
Bruce, thank you so much for the call. And I can relate, Regan, because I'm from Philadelphia and I'm a diehard Philadelphia Eagles fan. So you can imagine my excitement last February.
Yes.
Do you think it depends on what you're a fan of? Are sports fans experiencing more negative effects or positive effects than, say, fans of Harry Potter?
Yes, and here's why. Because unlike Harry Potter, which, you know, there's the series movies and there's a finite set, if you're a sports fan, every week, and especially if we look at the NFL, you know, right now where we are in the season, every week you don't know what the outcome is going to be. And, you know, I want to pick up on something Bruce said. Bruce, I don't think it's irrational to feel that way. It's not irrational. It's actually perfectly natural. If you really care about something, then if that something or somebody does not do well, in this case loses, well, I think it's very natural to feel bad. I mean, quite honestly, I can tell you, I reached a point when I used to watch games and I realized that maybe I was getting to be too much of a fan when I could literally feel my heart pounding. And I told myself, you know what? That's not good. I've got to come up with some way to not be so attached to the outcome of this game. So, you know, another element here, whether it's Eagles or Bears, it's the growing up. If you grew up with that team, you're going to get even more connected, and that's going to be an even deeper feeling.
Bruce, thanks for the call. You're having more fun than some of us this NFL season. We're talking to psychologist Regan Gruing from UW Green Bay about what it means to be a fan. Back to your calls now. Ryan is on the line in Watertown. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah, what are you a fan of?
A big fan of Spider-Man.
Ah.
Growing up, even in high school, I think that's when it really started. Because my uncle was really into comics, and I kind of got interested from him. But for me, just being, you know, kind of depressed kind of teenager, well, any anxious teenager, I just kind of related to the character of Spider-Man, which really helped back then, and this is fun that way.
Is there a movie incarnation of Spider-Man that you particularly attached to, Ryan?
I really had high hopes for the third one, the Spider-Man 3, but the character of Venom just really ruined it, unfortunately.
Ryan, thanks a lot for that call. That idea, Regan, of identifying in this case with a character that you're a fan of.
Well, and you know, something else here, especially with the comic books, what's really neat about the comic books is that over the, you know, history of comic books, you see reinventions. So you may not have liked, you know, the one form of Batman, but you may really like the Dark Knight. You know, as far as Spider-Man goes, I wonder if Ryan's watched the Spider-Verse, because that looks like another whole take on this, who Spider-Man is and what Spider-Man can be and all the things that can do for you. And I think that's something particularly neat about stories that are written, whether it's comic books or things like that, where there's this reinvention, and you may not like a certain iteration, but some other writer comes along, and bam, you're a fan of that writer and what he or she does to that character. So many different ways to go, especially in comic books. It's a good time to be a fan of comic books.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Dan in Drummond. Good afternoon, Dan. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. When I was younger and my friends were listening to rock music like that, what I got turned on by was polka music. And back in the 70s, in the late 70s, I had the chance to meet my idol, who was Frankie Yankovic. And nice. The first time I met him, it was just a quick handshake, hello, and that's it. A year later, I was in a car accident where I was on crutches. I was up, got up there early to sit. He came over, he put his hand on my shoulder and said, hey, Dan, what happened? And that just blew my mind. I mean, when a guy like that sees hundreds of thousands of people around the world and to remember just one person, that showed me what a true showman is like.
Dan, thank you so much for the call. That's an awesome story. Regan, do you think being a music fan can have those types of special benefits?
You know, I'm not sure. I don't know if it's special benefits per se, but I think, you know, Dan's a really lucky person to have that kind of interaction and not just that special story, but actually getting to meet his idol. I think in so many cases with music, you don't have the chance to actually meet the individual. And I think sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad, because I've read a lot of stories where a fan of a certain musician meets the musician and she or he isn't what they had in their heads, you know? And I think that's one of those things when you hold somebody up and appreciate somebody, meeting them in person, especially with a lot of celebrities, who are they really, right? Do we really know? And I think that's one of those big question marks.
Regan, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Regan Grurug is the Ben J. and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. He joined us to talk about what it means to be a fan.
Coming up, President Trump says ISIS is finished in Syria. Military advisors and members of Congress say not so fast. We'll get the latest on his call to bring troops out of Syria coming up. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, is this you? You're planning a big meal for the holidays, maybe Christmas Eve, Christmas, New Year's, whichever, but you don't know what you're gonna make yet for everybody coming over. Well, The Morning Show has some help for you. Kate Archer-Kent and her guest will give some inspiration. Tune in for ideas, recipes, and you can call in and share some of your favorites as well. That's on The Morning Show tomorrow at 6. They had meatballs this morning. I don't know if that has anything to do with the segment tomorrow, but maybe that's a part of the holiday plan. I'm not sure. Again, that's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. And, of course, tomorrow afternoon on Central Time. This is going to be fun. It's this week's edition of Food Friday at 3:30. Our own Lori Skelton is going to be back with us, our foodie here at Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to talk about some New Year's resolutions for the kitchen in 2019. Maybe some ways you can expand your cooking horizons and palate. Maybe try a new method, a new ingredient. Lori's going to have ideas. Maybe fish will be my thing. I'm always kind of a chicken when it comes to cooking fish. We'll see what Lori has to offer for inspiration. That's tomorrow at 3:30 on this week's edition of Food Friday. In just a few minutes here on Central Time, we'll be talking about the president's plan to remove troops from Syria. He's looking at doing that possibly in the near future. Some updates on that. The White House also considering withdrawing troops substantially from Afghanistan. And the president says Defense Secretary James Mattis is planning planning to retire, that at the end of February. We'll be talking about all of those news items. That's coming up in just a bit here on Central Time. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Speaking of food, here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about, you love it, you hate it, lutefisk.
Lutefisk, cod that's been preserved in lye, is a Scandinavian delicacy. It's a polarizing dish. Some people grow up loving it, while others despise it. But that doesn't stop people from packing into the basement of the Christ Lutheran Church in DeForest every year. For months, volunteers plan the dinner and cook everything from scratch, including 1,900 pounds of lutefisk. I went to see what brings people back year after year.
Fish, please.
Yeah, I'm Dan Paulson with Christ Lutheran Church, and I'm one of the co-chairpersons of the lutefisk dinner. And how long have we been involved? Jan, we have been involved since about, what, 1975.
I'm Jan Schultz, live in DeForest. 38 years ago was the first dinner.
What it is, it's a cod or a whitefish, and then they dehydrate it and preserve that in lye, and then it has to be rehydrated and wash all the lye out.
When they were immigrating, when they came to this country from Norway, they preserved it and they could put it in their suitcases. It was dry, they could bring it here.
At Christmas, my father was 100% Norwegian, my mother 100% German, so I'm just confused. But at Christmas, we had the lutefisk dinner. My father on my left, my uncle on my right. They passed that dish back and forth between the two of them, and I couldn't stand the smell. And finally, when they killed all the taste buds in my mouth, then I started loving it. So it's an acquired taste. But my sons, they love it right off the bat. Here's some more of the cooks. You can see the kettle's of boiling water. So the boiling water drains off, and then we drop it into a dish, and that's where we separate the bones from the meat itself.
Yeah, once you get to be a bone picker, you never get rid of this job.
My name is Janice Tipple, and I live in the town of Windsor.
Janice, you said you became a member of Christ Lutheran. For what reason?
Because of the lutefisk dinner.
Really?
I did! Yes! We've been coming to this lutefisk dinner long before we became members. And it was the best lutefisk dinner, and we decided, well, we need to become members of this church.
One way to pick a church.
Today we have a lutefisk and Swedish meatballs with gravy, mashed potatoes, rutabagas, a delicious coleslaw, and lefse, and a melted butter, of course. Plenty of it. Matt Erlinson in Madison.
Wendy Bunster, Antigo, Wisconsin.
This is a generational type of thing. Our grandparents, great-grandparents. We were raised having lutefisk lefse
for Christmas dinner.
The smell one can never forget. It's not good. It has to do with the lye flavor.
Ask him, he travels to
all of them, practically.
They asked me how I found the lutefisk. I said there was a truck went by and we just followed our nose. My name is Dale, and my last name is Erlinson, and I live in Antigo. My nickname is Swede. That might have something to do with the fact that I like lutefisk. Well, mostly because it's a good fish. Because they cooked the lutefisk just perfect.
Our patriarchs here have been eating lutefisk since they could crawl, and it wasn't our favorite as children, but it's really grown on us, and now it's a great tradition.
Lutefisk, oh lutefisk, how fragrant your aroma.
This story is part of a new project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. And we want to hear about your own food traditions. Share them with us on Instagram. Just search for Wisconsin Life and hashtag foodtraditionswi. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, amid heavy criticism for his decision to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria, President Trump is defending his announcement on Twitter today.
He quoted Fox News host Laura Ingraham, who said on her show last night that Trump gets no credit for an improving situation in the Middle East. He also said the move shouldn't be a surprise, that he campaigned on it for years, and that the U.S. should not be the policeman of the Middle East.
Here's a clip from his video announcement yesterday.
We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land, and now it's time for our troops to come back home.
But several military advisors, along with House and Senate members, have said the job isn't done yet. A bipartisan group of six senators, including Republican Lindsey Graham, sent Trump a letter asking him to reconsider. Here's Graham on the Senate floor last night.
To say they're defeated is an overstatement and is fake news. It is not true. They have been severely damaged, but they will come back unless we're there to stop them.
Rukmini Kalamaki is a foreign correspondent for the New York Times who covers ISIS. Rukmini, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you tell us about the current state of American involvement? How many troops are there in Syria and what's their role?
Right now, there are around 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria, which in context is actually a very small number. During the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, at their heights, each of those countries had over 100,000 American troops stationed there.
And what are U.S. troops doing there in this confusing civil war in Syria?
They're there in a support role. The main way that the U.S. is helping the Kurds, who are our allies in that part of the world, is through air support. So the Kurds are on the ground advancing onto ISIS positions. When I was traveling with them, they always had iPads on them. And on those iPads, they would have the positions of suspected ISIS hideouts, and they would call in airstrikes that were being conducted by American pilots in American planes. And those positions would then be bombed, allowing the Kurds to then move in.
The president has said and tweeted that ISIS has been defeated, so the U.S. presence is no longer needed. Is there any agreement that ISIS has been defeated in Syria?
Not even close. ISIS currently, according to three independent reports that were just put out, has between 20,000 and 30,000 fighters just in Iraq and Syria. And to give you a perspective, the last time that the U.S. declared a victory over this group, which was back in 2010, the group was down to around 700 fighters. So now they have 20,000 to 30,000 fighters just in Iraq and Syria. That's not counting Afghanistan, the Sinai, West Africa, all the other places where they operate. So that gives you a sense of how dramatically larger they are than the last time we thought that they were dead. And that at that point in 2010, they clearly weren't dead. They came straight back.
Right. That's the fear of a repeat. We had this status of forces agreement signed under the Bush administration that, hey, we were going to be out by a date. We didn't get to renegotiate that. U.S. troops left. And then what became ISIS metastasized, if I can use a cancer metaphor here, yeah, and spread, right?
It did indeed. And part of the problem is that our leaders are publicly stating that American troops are leaving. This is what happened in 2010. The predecessor to ISIS knew that all they have to do is hunker down for a bit of time, and soon American forces will be out of their hair. And that's exactly what happened. American forces left by 2011. And by 2014, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and his army succeeded in taking a territory that was the size of Great Britain between Syria and Iraq.
Now, as you mentioned, the Kurds are the ones doing the frontline work here against ISIS. What have we heard from them, from their leadership, in response to the president's announcement?
I've been speaking to some of their leaders today on message chats, and they're completely baffled. This came out of nowhere. Just a couple of days ago, the State Department and their American counterparts were reassuring them that that American troops are there for the long haul. And they said to me that they really have no will to continue fighting ISIS. It doesn't make sense for them. To them, ISIS was, in a way, not the biggest enemy. They very much fear the clash that we believe is going to happen with Turkey. That's a different front. And that they are in the process of moving their fighters from the ISIS front to the Turkish front.
Right. The Turkish government opposes the existence of a Kurdish army on the other side of the border because of their concerns about their own Kurdish population, right?
Right. Turkey has long viewed the group that is in northern Syria as a direct extension of the PKK, which is a group that has been labeled by them a terrorist organization. They've been leading a low-level insurgency in Turkey for years and years. And so the presence of a group that is allied with the PKK in northern Syria is to Turkey, in a way, an existential threat.
Now, one of the president's arguments here has been, okay, we pull out the U.S. troops, and then ISIS is a problem for Syria, Russia, and Iran. They'll have to take care of ISIS. Is that something, is there any validity to that?
Look, those groups have not been fighting ISIS in the aggressive way that the Kurds have under the support of the American administration. So we can expect that the fight against ISIS is going to lapse, is going to miss a couple of beats, and we know that this group still has thousands, if not tens of thousands, of fighters, lots of money on hand, and so it looks like the landscape is really ripe for this group to rebound.
We're talking about President Trump's declaration that ISIS has been defeated in Syria and that it's time to get U.S. troops out of that country. Rukmini Callimachi is our guest foreign correspondent for the New York Times, who has been covering ISIS.
Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Should the U.S. pull its troops out of Syria, or is there still work for them to do? How concerned are you about ISIS in the Middle East? What questions do you have about the fight against ISIS? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're talking about ISIS. President Trump declared the group defeated in Syria and has ordered the Pentagon to pull U.S. troops out of that country.
Rukmini Callimachi is with us, foreign correspondent for the New York Times. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to the news, your questions for our guest. Again, 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. All things considered, National Public Radio just interviewed the last ambassador we had to Syria before the civil war. And he supports Trump's decision. I do too. But the reason he does is because basically Syria won the civil war about 2 years ago. As brutal as that dictatorship is, they won. So the Kurds refused to negotiate with Syria. So Trump's decision is to pull out in order to force the Kurds to negotiate with the government of Syria, because they live in Syria. So he supports the president's decision because it's the right decision to let people with local influence make their decisions to decide their future.
Jeff, thanks for that call. And we see Robert Ford told the New York Times the U.S. could continue to strike terrorist targets from the air even without those troops in Syria. Rukmini, your thoughts on that?
I mean, I guess the first thought is it's pretty unrealistic to say that the civil war in Syria has been won. People are dying there every day. The country is really a mess. The thing to keep in mind is the Kurds are our allies. They became our allies through a policy decision by the United States. We armed them, we supported them, we gave them logistical backing, we've given them air support. And throughout the Obama administration and in the early part of the Trump administration, the message that they received from the appointed leaders of the American government that were in that region was, we're here for the long haul. They assured them that they are there to support them. So part of what's at risk here is America's word in the world. We're looking like an unreliable partner. Basically, we've used these people to try to remove ISIS's territory from northern Syria, and the second it looks like the territory is gone, we bail.
The president is making the case that ISIS in Syria is a local problem in Syria. It's a regional problem in the Middle East. Is this a problem for the United States? Is ISIS still a threat to American interests, to American people?
Look, I just got back from Tajikistan, a country in Central Asia, where just a couple of months ago, two American cyclists, a young woman and a young man from Washington, D.C., were murdered by an ISIS suspect who had returned from Syria. And he had come back to Tajikistan looking specifically for Americans to kill. So the thought that we are somehow free from the influence of ISIS is naive, to say the least. Let's not forget the Paris attacks that killed 130 people in the streets of Paris in the Bataclan Concert Hall. They were led by 10 attackers, almost all of whom had come directly from Syria. They had been trained in Syria, they had attended ISIS's formation camps there, and they came back looking to kill Westerners in one of Europe's main capitals. It's unrealistic to think that this threat is done.
Now, this is all coming from the president. We see breaking news that President Trump says Defense Secretary James Mattis will be retiring at the end of February. We've heard talk that a lot of military advisors, other advisors were surprised by this decision, opposed it. We're hearing, as we heard from Republicans like Lindsey Graham, not happy about this. Do you think that there's enough out there in the military community, the political community, to change this policy now?
Look, we have seen a number of announcements by the White House that have come to nothing. We were promised that there would be a wall that would be built and that would be paid for by Mexico. That so far has not even come close to being true. So there is a line of argument that perhaps this is a distraction mechanism. This has been a month that has been difficult for President Trump and for his family. His charity has just come under scrutiny, etc. And that perhaps with time, this will sort of fall off the bandwagon. But at the same time, other people are taking this dead seriously, and I think the Kurds are the ones who are hearing this loud and clear. And in the story that was reported by my colleagues earlier this morning, one of the things that the Kurds are threatening to do is to release the several thousand very dangerous ISIS members that they currently hold in custody. Those ISIS members are being held in a facility in northern Syria. Their countries, including Britain, including Germany, including the UK, do not want them back because our legal systems are not able to deal with their crimes. If those people are released, you can only imagine what that will do to this conflict.
So what do you watch for? We're still on the first day, basically, after this announcement. What are you watching for as far as reactions from the Kurdish troops there, Turkey across the border, the Syrian government, and other parties?
Right now, the Kurds, in the last couple of days, the town that they were fighting to take back is a town called Hajin in northern Syria. And they had penetrated the town, and they had taken the core of the town, but according to my sources who are there on the ground, they had not declared the town freed because several suburbs on the outskirts were still infiltrated by ISIS. I'm curious to see whether the Kurds really do, you know, pull up the stakes and just leave that area and go to fight something that is more important to them, namely the aggression that they expect from Turkey. And if that's the case, we will have left a safe haven, a territory that ISIS controls, and a place where this group can regroup.
Do you see ISIS being able to take advantage of that, grow in Syria, maybe beyond Syria as well?
They've already grown much beyond Syria, much beyond Syria. This is a group that has recruited from 100 different countries, 100 different countries. Just get your mind around that. 40,000 foreigners flooded into this battle space from 100 different countries. I am following the group in West Africa, in Egypt, in Libya, in Tajikistan, in Russia, in China, in the Philippines, in Bangladesh, and of course in Europe and with followers in North America.
We'll leave it there for now. Rukmini, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Rukmini Callimachi is a foreign correspondent with the New York Times. She covers ISIS. We talked with her about President Trump saying ISIS has been defeated in Syria and saying that he will withdraw U.S. troops from that country.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a guest makes the case that public lands should stay public and warns against privatizing those lands for economic interests.
The internet is changing the way a lot of people save and spend money. Think about things like PayPal or Venmo or online banking. The list goes on, and the amount of choices out there can be overwhelming. Plus, who is out there that you can trust? We'll explore the frontiers of personal banking in the age of the internet.
And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. WPR's Lori Skelton will help us make New Year's resolutions to try something new in the kitchen.
And you can get us started right away. Is there something that you want to try in your cooking you want to tell us about on this edition of Food Friday? You can tell us about it. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. What is in your planning stage? What are you hoping to make? What do you want to expand your horizons with when it comes to your cooking in 2019? All that and look at some of the top news of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.